That rhetoric has fallen into disuse or abuse is nothing new. Aristotle begins his Art of Rhetoric bemoaning the fact that it has fallen into the hands of the sophists, who have been able to separate dialectic from the art of persuasion, and consequently, they're able to persuade others without reference to the truth. When Aristotle defines rhetoric as being the faculty, and here the word in Greek is dunamis, the word we get for dynamo, dynamic, dynamite. When Aristotle defines rhetoric as being the faculty of being able to discern the most effective means of persuasion for a particular audience, he intends for that persuasion to take place in accord with the truth, not independently from it. The process of arriving at that truth is dialectic, which is part of what used to be the heart of any liberal arts curriculum, the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. They are the arts of language we develop in relation to our minds. The other four liberal arts pertain to matter. Grammar is more than mere study of fragments and comma splices. It's the study of how orderly language communicates ontology through nouns, verbs, and metaphor. And I think that it's Richard Weaver's focus on ontology that makes his work central to the necessary steps in restoring the trivium to a position of respect. Logic is tied intimately to philosophy, to dialectic. Finally, rhetoric takes the truths arrived at in dialectic and applies them to current historical circumstances, persuading others to take similar actions. In other words, rhetoric develops the means of persuasion, whereas dialectic develops the actual truth of those ends of persuasion. Aristotle never intended for rhetoric to be divided from dialectic, but by Richard Weaver's time, academic specialization was such that one was either a rhetorician or a philosopher. One couldn't be both. But since rhetoric is the master art of the trivium, it has an advantage over the other two. Our current situation of sophistic rhetoric has been brought on by insufficient attention paid to dialectic. We're talking, communicating, persuading, all based on an incomplete understanding of our topics. Our faculty of mind has been impoverished by social media. Could you imagine reading the De Anima in tweets? If the medium is the message, then it's no wonder we can't communicate anything of substance. During this weekend, much will be made of Weaver's epigraph to the Ethics of Rhetoric, which he takes from Aristotle. Thus it happens that rhetoric is an offshoot of dialectic and also of ethical studies. But assuredly, Weaver intends the reader to supply the context of that quotation, or at least the rest of it, because Aristotle amplifies the phrase ethical studies and makes it synonymous with politics. Rhetoric argues for the adoption of the truths discerned in dialectic, and that public dimension takes on the role of politics. In a chapter on the fundamentals of grammar, Weaver discusses the high calling of this office of assertion. The liberty to impose this formal unity is a liberty to handle the world, he says, to remake it, if only a little, and to hand it on to others in a shape that may influence their actions. Debate in American politics is barely a conversation, much less a conversation with a goal, the aim of argument. The healthcare debate at the beginning of the year wasn't so much of a debate as it was a wait for the other party to stop talking. The president let everybody talk and talk and talk, said Senate Majority Harry Reid, who called Obama the most patient man in the world. Debate in America has been reduced to letting the opposition speak with absolutely no intention of changing one's mind. These events used to be debates about the merits of particular positions, but they've descended into forceful personalities snapping at one another. I'm more edified when I watch my 2-year-old and 4-year-old argue. Yes, it is. No, it's not. And so on. But wasn't this supposed to stop with the election of President Barack Obama? Wasn't he to be the second coming of Cicero, mutatis mutandis? After all, without a teleprompter, Cicero had to memorize his Philippics. As all of you know, there are three appeals that the rhetorician uses to persuade others: ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos has to do with the ethical character of the speaker. You are persuasive because of your background and your experience. Pathos has to do with persuading your audience through appealing to their emotions. And logos is the appeal to facts and reason. I think that reduction of all appeals to pathos, which is the result of the de-emphasis upon dialectic, is the root cause of our current political impasse. Most of our politicians just do not have the philosophical skills needed to be good orators. Interestingly, Weaver bemoans the loss of pathos in rhetoric, but he feared that the emergence of scientism would dominate all rhetoric, leading to robotic persuasion via fact, and that language would take on a lifeless utilitarianism. Today, he would be dismayed by the smothering of logos by pathos. And when I emphasize logos this morning, it should be understood as a restorative emphasis, not as a primary emphasis. Like Weaver, I agree that an overemphasis on logos threatens to treat all men as abstract thinking machines. But the loss of logos has occurred because of a loss of dialectic, and without the proper attention paid to developing the liberal art of logic, philosophy, it really won't matter what appeal is emphasized. Appeals to emotion are not intrinsically bad. Almost an entire third of Aristotle's rhetoric is devoted to outlining the various emotions, and many see him as the first systematic psychologist. But in Aristotle, the appeals to emotion were in place to bring men to the brink of decision and ultimately to action. Emotion was never meant to be a replacement for logic. Logos was to be the bridge that united speaker to audience in order to make the emotional appeal. If your audience is hostile to your position, and a good rhetorician knows this fact ahead of time, then you focus on rendering the facts of your proposition as objectively as possible. This isn't to say that you must be devoid of emotion, but you must take care that emotions do not build up a wall between you and your audience. Logos is always going to win out over time, and because it has the greatest longevity of the appeals, it's the most important. For example, look at President Bush. I lived in Texas when he was governor, and when he was elected, I worried, like all my other fellow Texans, about his lack of experience. All of us in Dallas had seen him at Arlington Stadium, aloof, throwing baseballs, when he was part owner of the Rangers. And it wasn't only his lack of experience, but his conservatism that had us worried that he'd be ineffective. It was fairly common knowledge that the real leader of Texas was Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, a Democrat. But rather than succumbing to impasse, Bush did very well, finding middle ground between the Republicans and Democrats through logos. So when he went to Washington after a contested election, I had hope. But after a couple of years, a bunker mentality developed, and officials with opposing viewpoints were not allowed to advise him. His penchant for neologisms notwithstanding, Bush's political rhetoric was compromised when he shifted away from making logo-centered arguments to making his case based in ethos, with occasional appeals to pathos. The pattern has been repeated by President Obama, but ironically, with less attention to logos than Bush. The force of the emotions and character were what gave Obama so much momentum, but emotions wear off, and character is eventually revealed through actions. Hence the supporter dissatisfaction that we've all been seeing on the news this week. Common ground in political rhetoric is found in logos. We may have a shared emotion, such as worry when our country is attacked or when our homes are in foreclosure, but long-term bipartisan success depends upon logos. The problems that the Obama administration plays at the forefront of its agenda, the economy, healthcare, the war in Afghanistan, aren't really susceptible to ethos or pathos in the absence of logos. One really has to know what one is doing before acting and persuading others to act. If the appeals made to the public are any indication, I'm afraid the proper time that should have been spent on dialectic hasn't been invested in recent and very expensive decisions. Our politicians at least used to make a general stab at statesmanship and promote the greatest of political goods, liberty. But what's the greatest political good in 2010? Is it not re-election? For better or for worse, our country is split almost 50-50 when it comes to voting patterns. So at any given time, our politicians are addressing audiences who are hostile to their views. Part of the genius of our most successful rhetorical presidents, Reagan, a rhetorician, and Clinton, a sophist, was their insistence upon addressing the very people with whom they disagreed. Reagan found common ground in our shared aspirations. Clinton found common ground by moving to the center of each group he addressed. One spoke for the good of others, one spoke of the good for himself. Perhaps we're dealing with a crisis of epideictic rhetoric brought on by the abandonment of dialectic. Epideictic rhetoric is concerned with praise and blame, the primary dialogue or form of rhetoric in politics, And our current politicians are so concerned with assigning blame that there's been little reflection about what to praise. According to Weaver, logos works only when a proposition's relationship to its opposite is clear. We've lost a key distinction between Republican and Democrat because both parties want to use the government to achieve their ends. When Senator McCain abandoned the campaign trail to return to Washington in 2008, conservatives looked to the maverick, only to be disappointed when he supported the economic bailout bill. President Bush oversaw a massive expansion of Medicare with its prescription drug benefit. In contrast, Reagan made clear distinctions between his positions and those of Carter. Bob Dole and John McCain lost their bids in large part because they could barely distinguish themselves from their opposition, and Kerry found himself in a similar problem when he ran against Bush. Of course, we are never persuaded by truth alone. Aristotle's ethics develops out of a rejection of Socrates' proposition that men develop vices only because of ignorance of the good, and Saints Paul and Augustine help us to understand how original and actual sin have clouded and damaged our intellects. The shining example of Reagan's rhetoric shows us that all three appeals must be used at the same time. But demagoguery can overemphasize the appeals to emotions to the extent that the unthinking mob bent on change can elect an unqualified candidate or support destructive legislation. With demagoguery, there is the elevation of ethos. Personality is what is important and persuasive. The message is one of dissatisfaction, and the emotions are riled. President Clinton could have appealed to ethos better than any modern politician, and Reagan is his only possible rival. And before the Lewinsky scandal, he could change just about anybody's mind, for at least as long as his speech rang in the audience's ears. Every speech of his was a tour de force, which maddened his detractors. His downfall was a combination of the straightforward lie to the American people and a smug mockery of the deposition process. We all remember the famous, "It depends upon what your definition of is is." When he could no longer make appeals based upon ethos, his effectiveness evaporated. During the Clinton years, American political rhetoric entered an interesting phase, the perpetual campaign. We see this especially in the members of the House, but part of the impasse has been the result of our elected officials never getting around to the business of governing, much less leading. But the main cause of impasse has been the loss of logos. During the Democratic primaries, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama gave us two rhetorical appeals, ethos and pathos. Clinton had experience, Obama had excitement. Neither made logos the center of the campaign, but it's not like McCain did either. His campaign wasn't as lifeless as Dole's, but it was a similar ethos-based campaign that focused on his experience. Reagan ran on ideas, not only on personality, and not only on the emotions of a dissatisfied electorate. McCain might have been able to root his campaign in ideas, but the selection of Sarah Palin shifted his campaign to pathos. As we see in the president's current approval numbers, Obama did not win the election because America thought it was time for a socialist turn. And if the authors of Game Changer are to be believed, Palin was not interested in logos, and McCain was in the unenviable position of being unable to differentiate his views from the Democratic candidate. Logos can bring two dissimilar people together based upon sharing a logical proposition, or at least in being open to sharing a logical proposition. Pathos, as it's utilized in today's rhetorical climate, on the other hand, works only when your audience already agrees with you. Political stump speeches are not the loci of high rhetoric. Conceivably, there could be a speech rooted in logos that changes the minds of your audience, which is then concluded with an emotional appeal to action. And in the past, pathos was used exactly in that manner. Unfortunately, what's emerged in recent years is that pathos is used as the main foundation of political speech. Our current structure of political rhetoric is a variation of preaching to the choir, and if you're not part of that choir, then there's no rhetorical space to create a niche. Anti-war Republicans and pro-life Democrats aren't allowed into the larger discussion. I'm not against preaching to the choir so long as its limits are recognized. Sarah Palin has found her niche, I think, as a fundraiser and one who can revitalize the Republican base. She's probably not going to ever be a political philosopher, but give her Twitter or Facebook and the occasional catchphrase like Mama Grizzly, and she's remarkably effective for the short term. But for the long term, I'm arguing for a return to logos and political rhetoric, and the way to do it would be no surprise to Richard Weaver: poetry and philosophy. or to use the terms of the trivium, grammar and logic. Weaver concludes his Ethics of Rhetoric with a challenge for readers to consider whether the real civil disobedience must not begin with our language. And language is the most important component of where students and many adults fear to tread, lyric poetry. Poetry used to be the world's dictionary. It used to be where words were charged and recharged with meaning when images and phrases descended into cliché. A recovery of the habit of reading lyric is essential. The other dimension of the solution is the reestablishment of public philosophy. We live in a time where the majority of our citizens cannot speak coherently about metaphysics, and one of the main causes of our rhetorical woes has been the steady ascendancy of relativism. It's no accident that Weaver quotes Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals, the manifesto of relativism, in the final essay of the Ethics of Rhetoric, exhorting his readers to transvalue the values. Weaver suggests that the new form of civil disobedience involves restoring truth and moral absolutes to our rhetoric. But without a robust vocabulary at the service of a robust metaphysics, how can this ever begin to happen? The liberal arts can give culture the tools to enable more than merely a forced and marginalized niche within a political platform. The higher purposes in rhetoric are neither useless nor are they unattainable platitudes. Weaver, in his essay, Language is Sermonic, outlines the importance of logos. Rhetoric presents its arguments first to the rational part of man because rhetorical discourses, if they are to be honestly conceived, always have a basis in reasoning. Logical argument is the plot, as it were, of any speech or composition that is designed to persuade. We've lost the plot of political rhetoric and will continue to be unmoored unless the primacy of logos is restored. Thank you.